So I'm here to talk about leadership and its relation to ethics, and hopefully that's of interest to you. As I've been doing some of my work at the Naval Academy, I've been looking at leadership from a theological perspective, and really looking at the Christian New Testament and the Gospels through the lens of leadership, and it's opened up some aspects of those texts that I hadn't considered before. And so what you see in leadership scholarship is one is a lot of confusion, actually. Christian leadership scholarship focuses on servant leadership, which is great, but I'd like to make the assertion that there's a lot more in the Gospels about leadership than just being a servant leadership. Servant leadership in some ways really is the pinnacle of leadership, and I'll mention that a little later. But there's a lot of resources in the Gospel narratives that talk about leadership. So that's what I've been trying to do. And so in reading some authors that you know shed light on the Gospel and different aspects of phenomena associated with leadership. So it's hard to talk about leadership because there's just cacophony in noise about leadership too. Like if you go into the Naval Academy Library and go, and this is probably true in Georgetown too, if you go to the leadership section, there's like a wall of books that like stands from here to infinity. And they're written by really, really accomplished people too. And they all have their different theories. There's a woman up at Harvard University who's Barbara Kellerman, and she's at the Kennedy School of Government, I think. And she's a leadership writer, and she's actually very critical of the industry. She talks about it, she says, there's 40 full-blown theories of leadership and over 1,000 definitions of leadership. The leadership consulting industry is a $40 billion a year industry in the U.S. So her point is there's a lot of leadership consulting going on, and it doesn't seem like leadership's getting any better. It might be getting a little worse. So what's the value in that? So sometimes it's hard to put leadership in a box and really talk about it concisely. So I'm going to try and do that. I don't want to add to the noise so much. So what I want to do with to describe leadership, just try and keep it simple, is that leadership is the ability to get someone to do something, basically, to inspire another person to accomplish a task or achieve some kind of mission, so to speak. And leaders should be too often leaders. People, followers act despite leaders rather than because of their leaders. I happen to be working with one of those right now. Although it's a simple idea in some ways, it gets really complicated really quickly. What I'd like to do is just offer a very quick description and say, leaders can influence their followers in different ways, and they can have different levels of effectiveness. So just kind of like a four-step process that we've talked about at Navy a little bit is, you have leadership as instruction. You tell someone how to do a particular task, and hopefully they'll be able to do it. You have leadership as example, which becomes more powerful because you're showing people how to do it, that they can do it. And then you can move into inspirational leadership. And this is where leadership can start to get really powerful, where you're enlisting people's desires to do whatever the mission happens to be. So you're tying the task to their own aspirations, so to speak. And then lastly, you can say you can have compelling leadership, where the effect of the leader on the followers is they're almost compelled, that they see enormous meaning in the task, and their attitude is, I am the person that has to accomplish this thing. That's kind of like the holy grail of leadership, so to speak. And what's really interesting, and this is something that I have not heard a lot of leadership people talk about, is that behind inspirational leadership, I think, and compelling leadership, to get up to that level, you have to enlist the notion of freedom, that people don't offer their enthusiasm and their commitment without freely choosing to do so. So in the background of excellent leadership is this freedom where the follower freely chooses to commit to whatever the mission is, and even to commit to the leader himself or herself. There's a bond there that's freely chosen, and that can be really powerful. So the most compelling leaders leverage that bond. So that's one of the points I try to get to. So there are two. It works. All right, great. I always have trouble with my clickers here. So there are two historical figures that have things to say about leadership. Jesus and Machiavelli. They seem to be very different, and the reality is they are very different. So what I thought is I'd give a little description about each of them, and then go into leadership on the basis of two of Machiavelli's observations in print. So with Jesus, he seems like an unlikely leader. If you look at his resume, it's not the resume of typically of an intellectual leader. He's somebody who's born in poverty, grows up in a rural backwater. He associates with lonely people. He doesn't have any significant formal education. Doesn't have a paying job that we know of. Seems to seek out the outcasts. Seems to shun any kind of institutional power that is normally associated with leaders, whether it's legal, political, military, things along those lines. He's got none of that going for him. And if you look at his story, you know, he seems to be, you know, obviously he's an influential teacher, but he almost seems to be very naive, very idealistic. He seems to be a dreamer. At worst, he's a subversive, and we all know the story. He he runs afoul of the authorities of his day, and gets executed in the most humiliating fashion possible. Right. So that's not the typical resume or CV of an influential leader. So it seems strange to even bring him up as a leader. And what's interesting, like if you go on the internet, and I know everything on the internet is true. So when you go on the internet, and if you go like look for top leaders in history. You know whose name is not on the list? Jesus' name. What's interesting is that, you know, one historical figure, you know, one name that's on every list and usually in the top 10 of the greatest leaders in history? Any guesses?
Julius
Caesar. Well, Caesar's usually up there.
Genghis Khan.
Genghis Khan's usually there. Yeah, but who's the worst possible example of humanity of a leader that you see? Yeah, Hitler is in the top 10 every time. So how do you define great? It's interesting, but you know what's interesting about the list too is they're very, and I'm reading English lists, they're very candid towards us and towards recent history. So I did find Jesus on one list that kind of updates itself regularly. So a couple of years ago, he was number 39 on the list, right behind Robert Kennedy. Robert Kennedy was number 38. And then number 31 was a guy named Arminius. Have you ever heard of Arminius? So usually there's like one person in the crowd. But apparently, I had never heard of Arminius. I had to look him up. I was like, who is this guy? He was a Germanic general in the first century that gave the Romans a lot of trouble, and so they made him into a Roman and kind of pulled him onto their side. So apparently, he was influential at the time. So Jesus is not on the list. And maybe it makes sense because of that resume I just talked about, and also, where am I? Also, he seems to his shtick, his morality seems to encourage the opposite of what we think is helpful to leadership. It seems, number one, he's got a very high standard of morality. If you look at the Sermon on the Mount, you know, he's talking about turn the other cheek and, you know, walk an extra mile, give your cloak to the person that takes your coat, these kinds of things. And he ends it up, tops it off with be perfect as your Heavenly Father is perfect. So it's a very high standard of morality. But it also seems to be a passive and meek standard of morality too. So, you know, blessed are the meek, they'll inherit the earth, and the Beatitudes. And he talks about, you know, taking the lowest seat at the table, don't grab the upper seat of the table, which is interesting because I did my dissertation defense. I did my dissertation on humility in Augustine. I'm driving into the defense and I'm very nervous about the whole thing. And as I'm listening, this is probably dating myself, but I remember I was listening, I think, to NPR or something like that. And President Obama was doing a talk at a women's college in Manhattan. I'm forgetting the name of it. It's like starts with a B, like Barnum or something like that. And he was talking at their commencement, and he said, "What you need to do is seize the top seat at the table." So literally the opposite of what Jesus was saying. It was like, well, it's not where my dissertation is going, but I'll worry about that later. But he seems to is not only in his teaching, but the way he lives out in his teaching, it seems like he's passive and he's meek. It's kind of like a recipe for getting walked on. That seems contrary to what we would think that would produce good leadership results. But what's fascinating about Jesus also, if you look at his historical effects, this is a map of the world religions, and you know, so you see there's a multiplicity of religions, but all the purple are the countries that are primarily followers of Jesus, you know, people that adhere to the Christian faith. And so when you think about his impact from a leadership perspective, it's almost incomprehensible. So how did he do it? You know, especially given the fact when he had virtually no resources. And, you know, so from a Christian, a theological, faithful perspective, we say, well, he rose from the dead, so that's, you know, that's a pretty good calling card to attract followers. Um, But if you stop there, I think you you miss a lot of what's available in the gospel to teach us about leadership. And so that's what I want to do, is kind of do that. And one of the great foils for this is Machiavelli. So I'm assuming most of you are familiar with Machiavelli. You know, he was in Florence in the late 14, early 1500s. He worked for the Florentine Republic from, gosh, it was like 1490 something to 1512. The Medicis came back to power, and so he got ousted. You know, it's interesting, in reading the history, he sounds a lot like Cicero, actually. Cicero was a political figure, and then he got on the wrong side of the politics, so he had to go to his second job, which was philosophy. You know, at least it wasn't theology, father. So, you know, but very similar to Machiavelli. But Machiavelli is obviously a very talented guy. He did all kinds of writing. And for the Florentine government, he was their writer, he was their secretary, he was a diplomat, he was in charge of their militia at one point. So obviously a very talented person, and extraordinarily influential. So he writes the prince after he's exiled, after he's put in jail by the Medicis, and in an attempt to get back in good with the powers of the time. And so he's obviously a controversial figure, and he's obviously had a huge impact. And if you look at, if you go on Google Scholar and take a look at all the literature that's focused on not just Machiavelli, he's very influential in political theory, but also in leadership circles, in leadership studies. Leadership has become, trying to become a discipline of its own. It's kind of a meta-discipline because it draws from all kinds of different fields of study. But he's very influential on those things as well. And some people say he's the worst, some people say he's the best. Certainly he's controversial. When your name becomes an adjective, though, you know you've had an impact. And so certainly he's had an impact. And I think he asks some great questions, and he's a very clear and concise thinker and a clear and concise writer, so that's one of the things that's drawn me to him. So I think he has two insights in The Prince that I think are worth thinking about. This is a great quote, so sorry to read a quote to you, but I love it. It's, how one lives is so far distant from how one ought to live, he's saying, if the leader does this, that he who neglects what is done for what ought to be done sooner affects his ruin than his preservation. For a man who wishes to act entirely up to his professions of virtue soon meets with what destroys him among so much that is evil. And, so we live in a fallen world, and if you want to be the good person in that fallen world, you're going to get crushed, especially when it comes to the powers of politics and the powers of the state and when you're involved with leadership. And what's interesting is that I'm reading Machiavelli in some ways probably illegitimately. It's like I'm putting a focus on what the implications of his ideas are for leadership, when he was probably thinking about leadership, but more broadly about government and how a prince maintains power. But I'm not the only one doing that, and what he's asking actually does have implications for leadership. And this is a really important idea that he has here. He also talks about love and leadership. So he's not the only great philosopher that's raised this issue. Michael Scott, "Would I rather be feared or loved? Easy, both. I want people to be afraid of how much they love me." It's funny. I mean, actually, so that video is online, and then I think it's too funny. They took it down, and I can't find it online anymore. Otherwise, I would have played it for you. But what's interesting is he must be a great philosopher, because that's exactly what Machiavelli says. He says that a fear, should a leader be feared or loved? Machiavelli says both. But the reality is, you can't be both. So if you can't be both, choose fear for two reasons. One is that, and I think this is a great insight on this part, is that you cannot control love. You cannot make somebody love you. That's the freedom and the voluntary aspect of it. And so he says, go to what you can control. You can make somebody fear you. And so that's what you can control, so go for that. But then he also says, and not only that, it's not just that you can control fear, but fear is more powerful. Fear pushes people harder than love does. And so he makes the observation that somebody that's attached to a leader only by, the attachment of love, it's too weak. It's too weak, and as soon as their interest diverges from the leader's, they're gonna leave. And so with these two insights, it's really interesting. If you apply this to the gospel narratives, it seems he's describing exactly what happened to Jesus. So Jesus is going around talking about, no greater love than this, and lay down your life for your friends, and things along those lines. And when push comes to shove and the crisis, hits, what happens? He gets betrayed by Judas, he's abandoned by his disciples, and he's condemned by the crowds and the authorities of the day. So it seems like what Machiavelli is saying kind of is the setup for what we see in the gospel narrative. So so that's it. That's all I have to say. No, I'm just kidding. I don't agree with Machiavelli. I think he makes a real mistake with his notion of love and fear. I think that is really mistaken, actually. And I want to get to that, but I want to talk about, you know, so he's got some insight about morality. How can you be a moral person, you know, in a world that's very fallen, and we all know it's fallen. And this is where he's on solid foundation, is that the arguments that Machiavelli is making are arguments on the basis of human sin and human corruption. And guess what? There's a lot of that. You know, I say that being in Washington, D.C., that there might be some corruption in government and things along those lines. So there's a lot of that. He's got some solid foundations in there also. So he talks about morality, he talks about this idea of love, but I think he gets them both wrong, actually. He asks good questions, I don't think he comes to good conclusions. When we're talking about leadership, when we're talking about a leader's influence on their followers, and he was, to be fair to Machiavelli, he was talking about more broad things also, but within his thought, if we focus on, you know, what the immoral or corrupt leader does in relationship to their activity and how that affects their followers, I think you see a detrimental effect. And then this balance between fear and love, I think he gets that wrong too. So what I want to do for the morality is there's a lot of ways to approach this, actually. At the Naval Academy, we're actually looking primarily at our ethics curriculum in terms of, you know, we do contemporary thought, we do Enlightenment thought, but we also want to look at ethics through the lens of virtue theory. And that's one way to approach morality. I want to take one specific angle with that and talk about this idea of integrity. So integrity is kind of, it's almost a meta-virtue, and it's broad, and it's helpful to take a look at. It has a real impact on leadership and on the relationship between leaders and followers. So I think it's a nice lens from which to examine what Machiavelli has to say. So my focus is integrity. You know, he says a leader must be able to do wrong, and I think that's problematic, especially when you get into the ideas of habits. So the angle I want to take is integrity. And it's interesting because integrity seems like a word, it's not a word that you necessarily associate with Jesus in the Gospels. And you know, to be honest, I probably should look it up. You know, it's the Latin roots are integratio. And probably, I don't know if you know the Greek roots of it. I don't know if integrity ever pops up in the New Testament canon at all. But I'd have to look it up, to be honest. So integrity. So this is interesting. Like when I deal with the midshipmen and the undergrads at the Naval Academy, I say, what's integrity? And they always come back with this answer, doing the right thing when no one's looking. And I'm always very critical of that, because it's like integrity is a noun. That's like a verb, or it's like a whole mishmash of stuff. That's an effect of integrity. It's not integrity itself. And I get critical of it, and then it turns out C.S. Lewis was the person that came up with that, and he's probably a lot smarter than I am, so I probably shouldn't be too critical about it. But then I say, well, it's not an integrity. I think it's an effect of integrity. So then what is integrity? And then the room gets quiet, because we really don't know that much. So actually, you know, so this is interesting. My notions of integrity, I've gotten from a thinker that is at the Naval Academy as a senior fellow, but his day job is a lawyer at Georgetown University. I think you've heard of that place. So David Lubin is kind of the background on this integrity talk. So if we talk about integrity, we can talk about going back to the Latin root of integration. You know, integration is the joining of various parts into a contiguous whole. So integrity is associated with that. From the moral perspective, we think of integrity as a joining of a person's behavior with their moral principles. Okay. So, but that's not enough, because we look at integrity and we say, well, integrity is a good thing, but you can have an integration between bad moral principles and bad behavior. And integrity, since integrity is a good thing, we have to take one step further and say, well, if you have a union between bad moral principles and bad behavior, like you're the leader of a drug cartel or that guy up there, you know, that's corruption, okay? And that's a different thing, and there's a union there, certainly, but it's not integrity. It's integrity is, you know, just taking it as face value, it's a positive moral attribute. So integration of good moral principles with good behavior is integrity, okay? So we gotta kind of have that as a background. All right, so where do we see integrity in the Gospels, in Jesus' behavior? And this is interesting, because again, I don't see, you know, it's not like there's, you know, we talk about it in the Gospel narratives that much. And I pulled this out of the guy who doesn't talk about integrity either. And so I'm sorry to keep going into your father, but he's a Jesuit from Austria, Raymond Schwager, and it's just a fascinating book. And he's like a real systematic theologian. I'm like a make-believe one. This guy is, you know, he's a really great intellect. And so what's interesting about in this book is he asks a really hard question. He says, he asks, you know, why doesn't Jesus come down from the cross? He's trying to cope with that. And so he never talks about integrity at all. But as I was reading this, I was saying, you know what? As he, through his analysis, you can see integrity as a function of Jesus' behavior. So how do we get there? And so he was actually following a very influential Swiss Reformed theologian named Karl Barth, or Barth, I should say, from Europe in the 20th century. And he says it's very ironic that the one who came to announce judgment, you know, repent for the kingdom of God is at hand. So Jesus' initial public proclamation is a judgment. And so the one that is announcing judgment ends up being judged. And so Schwager, on the basis of Barth, says, hey, it's not only ironic, it's that the text is saying, hey, something important is going on here, so we should pay attention, okay? So what's going on? So and I can't go into all the details of it because it would take a while, and I can't remember it all off the top of my head, but Schwager has this really fascinating analysis about judgment and how Jesus actually judges and how he's come to actually pass judgment on the interpretation of the law, the interpretation of the Torah from the religious authorities at the time, that he comes, as he says in Matthew 5, not to abolish the law, but to fulfill the law, but he also comes to condemn the contemporary interpretation of the law at the time, that the law at the time was very legalistic and it was very condemnational, and contrary to, say, John 3:16, that the Son of God came so that all would be saved, the judgment of God is judgment for salvation. The judgment of the religious authorities at the time was for condemnation. So you have the judgment of the woman caught in adultery. This is that not only was it for condemnation, it was for death also. That there was a combination of judgment and violence that was part of the culture that Jesus comes to condemn. It's really fascinating. And if you ever read Matthew 23, Jesus, we like to think of Jesus as such a nice guy, preaching love and peace and everything. If you read Matthew 23, he's not always the nicest rhetorician, at least. Is that that chapter is all condemnation of the religious authorities and their hypocrisy. What he was after was sinners condemning sinners. He really didn't have a lot of patience for that. So what's interesting is that Jesus passes judgment on the religious authorities because he knows what they're going to do back to him. They're going to judge him and they're going to condemn him because that's what they did. That was the entire culture that he came to overturn, so to speak. And so they do that, and what it does is it sets up an opportunity for him to live out, the teachings that he had preached earlier in his public career. And he ends up living out what most people would consider the highest parts of his teaching and the most hardest and maybe the most absurd. The parts about loving enemy and praying for those who persecute you and things along those lines. So what Schwager says in his book, and I think it's fair, is that what you have in the narrative in the Passions is the living out of what Jesus talks about, the moral life that Jesus talks about in the Sermon on the Mount, so to speak. So he prays for his enemies on the cross. He articulates love of enemy in Matthew 5:38. But he gives more than his cloak. He does more than turning the other cheek. He gives his very life. In John 15:13, Jesus says, "No greater love has a person than this, than to lay down his or her life for his friends." And so it's interesting, pulling Paul's letter to the Romans into that 5:68, Paul says, "What's so unique about the crucifixion is that Christ is dying not just for his friends, but for everybody, for people who are indifferent to him, even for people that hate him." And so this is the unique aspect of the crucifixion. And so what you see with the crucifixion is Jesus had, prior to the crucifixion, had preached about love of enemy, and then through the Passion narratives lives out that love of enemy at an even higher level than what he articulated in his preaching, so to speak. And so what you have is an integration between the moral principles he espoused and what guided his behavior, so to speak. And I think this is one of the reasons that when we talk about that map, you know, this is one of the reasons that he was followed by his followers, you know, according to the narratives, is that he was a person who preached a very high standard, but he actually lived that high standard also. That's very attractive for followers. And I think we can say it's attractive for followers, but I think we have to answer exactly why that's the case. So how is integrity related to leadership? And you can say that integrity really is one of the ways. You can say this in different ways. You can say moral excellence, habitual moral excellence is another foundation for trust. But you can say integrity is a foundation for trust. That when you see a person of integrity, you're more likely to trust someone like that than say a hypocrite. And it's easier actually to take a look at you know the dynamics. Sometimes it's easier to look at the opposite and then move into the phenomenon we're examining. So just to look at hypocrisy, you know, hypocrisy is corrosive to trust because it's a form of dishonesty. The hypocrite is lying to other people. What's the most important form of lying might be that they're lying to themselves. And so, you know, people don't trust liars. You know, so for a leader to have influence over followers and to try to get them to do things, establishing a context of trust is crucially important. And if you're dishonest, whether it's in your words or your actions, in particular in your actions, that is corrosive to trust. Typically, also, hypocrisy comes out when people are trying to, you know, pursue their own self-interest. And so for leaders, one of the challenges for leaders is to demonstrate an ability to rise above their own self-interest, to be oriented towards, say, the accomplishment of their mission or the good of their followers. But our tendency is to look out after our own interests. So unfortunately, what hypocrites do is they give evidence of an inability to rise above their own self-interest. And that really is the opposite of a person of integrity. With the integrity, the reason that integrity is a foundation for trust is because the leaders are, I guess, you know, offering through their behavior, you know, assuming they're articulating good moral principles, through their moral behavior, they're actually opening up some transparency to the type of person that they actually are. Is that, you know, it's one thing to say something, but it's another thing to actually do it. So when your behavior is in line with the principles that you're espousing, or your behavior is sacrificing for the good task that you're trying to accomplish, you're giving evidence that you not only are saying what you think, but you actually really believe what you think. And so that's part of a leader's credibility. And then also, you have the opportunity as a leader sometimes to demonstrate your ability to overcome self-interest. And people that are able to overcome their own self-interest, whether it's, you know, to adhere to a moral principle that might, say, lose them money or things along those lines, when that kind of evidence comes out, followers are going to say, hey, well, that's a unique aspect of character that's worthy, one, of emulating, and two, maybe following also. So integrity can be a very powerful way for a leader to influence followers. And I think what you see, and I think this is part of Jesus' historical draw, part of how he gets followers to be completely committed to him is through the integration of his behavior, not only with moral principles, but with good moral principles, principles that people can respect and admire. And so I think it's problematic for Machiavelli is he's articulating an idea that, hey, sometimes, you know, the world is such that it is, you're going to have to do something wrong to, say, achieve a greater good, so the means justify the ends, things along those lines. And the reality is that those are difficult circumstances that a leader's going to come into. Whenever they make a choice like that, there's always a cost to the people that are following them if they observe that. There's always a cost. And, you know, what's interesting is that we have a case study at Navy where with the Navy, if you're on ships, you get inspected all the time. And so part of the inspections are your maintenance records. So the Navy is an industrial organization, and so one of the biggest concerns outside of combat is safety on, you know, on ships and aircraft carriers and things along those lines. And the way the Navy is safe is through documentation. Did you do the maintenance on this piece of equipment? Yes, and you sign it off. And so what's always a temptation is what's called gun decking. Yes. Has anybody ever heard the term gun decking? It is like everybody in the Navy knows what gun decking is. Gun decking is writing you did something when you really didn't. You know, so the temptation is that we have a case study where, hey, we're going to get inspected on Monday. We've got all this maintenance we got to do, and we're going to have to work the whole weekend. Well, they're probably not inspect the equipment, and we can do it Tuesday or Wednesday. Let's just sign it off, and we'll come back to it. So that's the human tendency. And the problem with that is, one, if you don't come back to it and it doesn't get done, that can be a safety issue, a very significant safety issue. Two, there are habits being formed. Three, though, as the leader, like, so the people that graduate from the Naval Academy, they go out and they become division officers. And so they're in charge of a division of 10 to 20 people. And as soon as you say gun decking is all right, because it's in your interest as a division officer, say in this scenario, your commanding officer, you're telling your commanding officer all the work is done. As soon as you say, hey, I can do that to the commanding officer, you just told everybody in your division they can do that to you too. So these are, you know, so whenever you make that kind of breach, you're affecting the not only your own integrity, but the relationship between you and your subordinates, and you're also affecting the institutional integrity of your organization, actually. And this happens, you know, there's other stories about, you know, in Vietnam, when the National Security Council was sending bombing coordinates for Cambodia to people in Vietnam, and that were different than the Pentagon, so they could have a clandestine war in Vietnam and be more effective from a military perspective. That was fundamentally problematic from the perspective of can citizens trust their government when the government is lying to itself. But also the people that were involved in that realized that, you know, they got orders for bombing in Vietnam from the Pentagon, they got orders for bombing Cambodia from the National Security Council, and the reality was they could have bombed anywhere. There was no accountability. So these types of things have pernicious effects in ways that you won't really realize. Okay. So, all right. So we spent a lot of time on integrity. I want to go now to this idea of love. So Machiavelli says it is better for a leader to be feared than loved. And so, love is such a complex phenomenon also. And I'm gonna basically reduce it to a proper secret here. But when I talk about love, I'm gonna talk about there are Greek roots, and there are also Christian roots. You can see in the terms eros and agape. So eros is love of desire, and agape is self-sacrificial love. You see agape very much in the Greek New Testament. You see eros in writers like Plato and the Symposium. If you read the Symposium, it's just a great depiction of eros as love of desire, more than just sexual desire that we talk about. But love is, the ultimate love from Plato's perspective was the love of virtue, love of the good, so to speak. So yeah, you have these two dynamics that are constantly interplaying. A couple of good authors on it. C.S. Lewis has written a book called The Four Loves, which is really, really interesting. And one of the most concise summaries of the dynamic between eros and agape is Pope Benedict's encyclical Deus Caritas Est. Like, the first 15 pages really surveys all this rich literature and gives you a nice summary of the relationship between the two. So I'm just going to leave it at that. A lot of times we say, well, eros is the bad Greek philosopher is just talking about desire, but the reality is that eros is very important to Christian love. St. Augustine used to talk about, love is the weight that moves me. Love is what drives us. And then when we come into contact with the object of love, that's when agape kicks in and purifies the love of eros, so to speak, so that eros doesn't devour the object. So there's a lot there. So that's kind of all in the background of that. So he says it's better to be feared than loved. And again, another great thing here, before I get to that, love is the power. I want to offer that love is the power that drives compelling leadership. If you want to get to that highest level of leadership where you're inspiring followers to sacrifice themselves for you as the leader, for the good of the mission, love is the most powerful way to do that. So that's controversial, sounds very romantic. Some people argue against it, so another great philosopher, Dwight Schrute, says, there's nothing stronger than love. False Apache helicopter is stronger than love. It has both guns and missiles, so it's hard to beat that kind of logic, right? So I'm going to try. So there are other people that would offer that love is very powerful in leadership. And it's interesting to turn to the military, who are we're not supposed to be touchy-feely. We're all a bunch of tough men and women, doing hard work. But this guy talks about love and leadership in a very eloquent way. So he's actually a graduate from the Naval Academy in 1888, he was General Lejeune, was a long career. He ended his career after World War I. He was one of the senior generals in World War I, United States Marines. Very much, he was a leader, but he was also a thinking leader, for lack of a better term. He thought about leadership, wrote about leadership a lot, and actually the Marine Corps University that does all the education and training for the Marine Corps established a leadership institute in Quantico, not too far away, about 15 years ago. They named it after LeJune. So LeJune is one of the leaders par excellence in the history of the Marine Corps. And so he tells a story at the end of World War I that's really interesting, and you see it in his diaries, actually, where it's November 12th, 1918. So that's the day after the war ends. The armistice is on the 11th hour, the 11th day of the 11th month. And so he's touring the hospitals in France where injured Americans are being cared for. And he comes up to a gunnery sergeant who's leg had just been amputated. And so he engages the sergeant and says, "Hey, what happened?" And he said, "Well, we were with my squad, and my platoon commander grabbed about eight of us and said, 'Hey, we have to take this bridge.' And there was a lot of enemy fire going over the bridge." And the general's like, "Did you know that the armistice was about to be signed? It was literally the last day of the war." And he's like, "Yeah, we all knew that." And so the general said, "Why did you do it?" And he said, "Well, Lieutenant," and I don't remember the name of the lieutenant, "Lieutenant so-and-so said, 'I'm taking that bridge and you're coming with me.'" And so the general said, "Well, why did you go with him?" And he said, "Well, we weren't going to let him do that by himself. We loved him too much." And so as LeJune reflects on that, he says that says more about leadership than all the books that have ever been written about leadership. It's that bond of love between the follower and the leader is the most powerful bond that can exist. And it's interesting because it's high risk, one, because there's self-sacrifice involved, and two, it has to be authentic. If you fake that, one, you're not a nice person, you're not a good person, and it'll be found out at some point, and things are not going to go your way. So it has to be authentic. And this is the model of leadership that we see in the New Testament. It's articulated and it's counterintuitive. I think from the perspective of a parable, it's probably most powerfully articulated in John 10 with the parable of the Good Shepherd. That the Good Shepherd, it's interesting, as he says, the Good Shepherd knows his sheep and the sheep know him. They won't respond to the stranger, but they will respond to the Good Shepherd. So there's an intimacy between the leader and the follower. Also, the Good Shepherd lays down his life for the good of the sheep. And the hired hand will not do that. Only the Good Shepherd, only the owner of the sheep is willing to do that. And so you kind of have this twofold dynamic of intimacy and then self-sacrifice, which is, again, a form of agapeic love, so to speak. And so there's a bond of intimacy and there's a bond of love between the leader and the follower. And that's why the followers, that's why the sheep follow the shepherd, the followers follow the leader. That's where the power of leadership is. And this is the background to Jesus' explicit teaching on leadership, and this is where we get to servant leadership. This is counterintuitive, but this articulates what he's talking about in the parable of the Good Shepherd, say, in an abstract way, but we're all familiar with this. You know that those who are recognized as rulers over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones make their authority over them felt. But it shall not be so among you. Rather, whoever wishes to be great among you will be your servant. Whoever wishes to be first among you will be slave of all. And he's not saying that, just to articulate a high standard. He's articulating what will work in leadership, and that's what will work in leadership. It's a leader that's willing to sacrifice for the good of his or her people and for the good of their mission. That's the leader that people will follow. So this is one last quote to leave you with. So this is taken from General Bertrand's diaries and his dialogues with Napoleon in St. Helena, and this is Napoleon's second exile. So the problem with this quote is we don't know if it's true. General Bertrand is honest, it's true. So what I want to say is that if Napoleon didn't say this, he should have, because he was honest. All right? So then the quote is, "Well, then I will tell you, Alexander, Caesar, Charlemagne, and I myself have found a great empire. But upon what did these creations of our genius depend? Upon force. Jesus alone founded his empire upon love, and to this very day, millions will die for him." So that's what Machiavelli's thinking misses. And it's interesting because Machiavelli is very wise in his ways. You could say he's the prophet of modern leadership, and he's recognizing corruption, and he's operating within that context. But because he's only within that context, he's limited, and he can't access the power of love that can exist between a leader and a follower. That's the power that can turn into compelling leadership. That's the power that enables, you know, a follower to say, hey, I'm willing to do anything to accomplish the mission that my leader puts before me, even up to the point of dying. You know, and that's the thing, you know, I don't try to glorify the military too much, because the military's got its warts and its foibles and all kinds of problems. But when we get into combat, one of the things we aspire to is that level of leadership. And if you read a lot of history books, we don't get up there, but sometimes we do. And when we do, it's on the basis of integrity, high moral principles, and loving self-sacrifice for the good of the mission and good of the people that you're working with, too. So that's my spiel. I really appreciate, you know, your time. I hope it was worth your time. There's we have a few minutes before the hour, and I thought I'd cut off there and see if anybody had any questions or wanted to take on my criticism of Machiavelli.
Could I ask a quick question?
Yes.
I know others will have questions, but I was thinking about what leaders in American military history might be the exemplars of love, and two people come to mind.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you might comment. I think of George Washington and Robert E. Lee.
Yeah, so I know more about Washington than Lee. I've been reading a little bit more about Lee more recently, and I probably need to know more. Washington's just a great example of it. And, you know, what's interesting is, and I don't know if you have anything in particular in mind, Father, but, you know, one of the most powerful stories about Washington is when, at the end of the Revolutionary War, the soldiers hadn't been paid for some crazy amount of time. It was years. And if I got any history majors, probably tell me it was like 2 or 3 years they really hadn't been paid at all. And they were in an uproar. They were ready to rebel and actually attack the United States. The Continental Army was ready to fight. And so Washington gets up in front of the army that he's been with, living with for so long. And he's got a prepared speech. He's going to try and talk them off the ledge. And what's really interesting is that they were angry. They were angry at everything. They were angry at him too, as their leader. And so he's reading off his comments, and he's getting older. He can't read, and he has to. He said, "Excuse me, I'm sorry, but I have to grab my spectacles." It's like age and the weary work has had an impact on my eyes. And that's what, just that comment and that gesture is what softened the crowd. That they, you know, he kind of unwittingly reinvoked the bond of love that he had forged with all his soldiers through great suffering, and it completely turned that issue in a way that his words probably never would have. Actually, if he had given the speech, probably they probably still would have been very angry. But I think Washington is an exemplar for that. He was with the troops as they suffered in the cold and all those things. So I think absolutely. I think that's absolutely the case. I've read Killer Angels, a couple of books, so I'm not a Civil War buff. I don't know if you have any examples of why, you know, it seems like the soldiers were attached to Lee in a very similar way that they were attached to Washington.
That's what I gather from all I've read and heard about him. And since I think he graduated number one from his West Point class.
Yeah.
And he was recognized as a man of very high talent.
Mm-hmm.
But what they say about him is that there was no arrogance, no sense of self-serving about him, nothing condescending about him as well.
That's a really...
And it was the combination of the two that apparently was very winning.
Yeah, so this is interesting. I mean, you're absolutely right. I think, you know, from the perspective of leadership, humility is making a resurgence.
Humility, that's the word I'm looking for.
There's a lot of research on the impact of a humble leader, and it's very positive. But what's interesting, I don't know if you're familiar, what you just described is one of the most influential views of leadership right now on the basis of General Lee's, from this book called Good to Great. I don't know if you've heard about this. It was a book written in the 90s, and it was a business book trying to track, you know, they had a study group that tracked, Jim Collins is the author, he's at West Point and Harvard, actually, but he led a team of researchers that studied 10 companies that made the leap from good to great you know, based on their value in the stock markets in various different industries, and then and compared them with a control group of companies that, you know, basically just flatlined the whole time over the course of, I think the time period was from 1970 to 1990. And so they wanted to see what do these companies do? And one of the interesting things that they kept coming back to was that all 10 companies had the same type of leader. And he did not, as he intros the book, he says, I don't want this to be a leadership book. I don't want this to be a book of, oh, they had a great leader and that's it, end of story, so to speak. But the data kept coming back to him. They all had the same leader. And it was just as you described Robert Lee. Somebody, and they didn't talk about the talent thing so much, but they said it was a humble leader with fierce resolve. That combination was at every single 10 out of 10 companies. You had that combination. And I think this, especially when you have a talented person like General Lee probably was, when a talented person who could probably have the right, if anybody has the right to be arrogant, is very humble, is a compelling and attractive aspect that just draws people to that leader, actually. When you're talented and you're not high on your horse, I mean, people really, really come to you. People really come to you. And so that's the complexity of this leadership thing, is that there are so many different angles and so many different aspects that you can approach. And that's one of the more powerful ones. Sir?
I'm going to push back a little bit. So I'm thinking of when Christ tells the parable of the dishonored, the dishonorable steward.
Dishonest
steward.
Actually, that was like in Mass, like a month ago, I think.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And the steward acts, you might say, rather Machiavellian.
Right, absolutely.
And achieves worldly results.
Yeah.
And the master seems to praises him for it.
Sure.
Or it seems like Christ is saying, at least this is, here's a prima facie way to read it. It's like, the Machiavellian way of this dishonest steward will yield you earthly results.
Right.
But I want something higher than that.
Right.
And so you won't be worldly wise. You will be a fool. You will be all these things to the world.
Yeah.
But then, isn't that just conceding then that Machiavelli's right? Like, if you do want to be a good leader in this world, be like the dishonest steward.
I would say not necessarily that Machiavelli is right, but that, you know, that he's got great insights. And you know, this is a struggle for me at the Naval Academy, actually. So I'm a military rep on I've been a military rep on some athletic teams, and Division I athletics, as people at Georgetown know, are very competitive, right? So we have head coaches that are under a lot of pressure. If they don't win, they get fired. They get paid a lot of money, they got big houses, they have families that are depending on them for education and all this kind of stuff, and then they have a 20-year-old who's shoplifts, gets kicked off the team, and they don't have a point guard. Not that would ever happen. As I'm engaging these people that are in really tough businesses where they have to produce results, well, that pressure comes out very negatively on their players a lot of times. And so I would engage them at times when I couldn't take it anymore because my head was going to blow up. And so really ridiculous behavior, and say, hey, this is really kind of counterproductive. And what their reaction to that was that, well, you know, you just want to hug everybody. You just want to be nice. And we live in the real world, and you can't be like that in the real world, similar to your argument. And there's some truth to that. Like, so I was working with the basketball team, and the coach said, well, look at Bobby Knight. I'm kind of dating myself with Bobby Knight. Have you heard of Bobby Knight? He's, you know, a three-time national champion at Indiana. Not a very nice guy, but seems to be a very successful leader as a coach. And coaches truly are leaders. And so that's the complexity of leadership. Is, you know, the question I would offer to the coaches is say, well, if he had conducted himself in a way where his players actually were attached to him, could he have gotten better results? But you can definitely get some good results by being a corrupt person. There's no doubt about that. So I would agree with you. Like, you know, Machiavelli's been influential because he knows how to operate in this world. I guess my argument is just that. He has limitations also, and that it's not just about you know being good so we can attain the beatific vision in the next world. It's that these good actions actually produce good results here, and that's a challenge for me, you know, teaching ethics at Navy is that we want to teach ethics to our future military officers to say, not because we want the moral high ground, nothing wrong with the moral high ground, but the reality is that we do everything in teams, and if we don't trust one another, we don't have good moral standards, don't trust one another, our teams cannot function well. So that you know, these high moral standards actually help us be effective leaders too. So yes, Machiavelli's got some great insights, and I think a lot of those ideas are being used in this town maybe right now to some effect. And the reality is that the wisdom of Machiavelli also is, he did call it with Jesus. Jesus suffered. Jesus' approach is high risk. You know, long term, it works really well. But if you look at, you know, influential leaders of the 20th century, people like Gandhi, people like Mandela, people like Martin Luther King, it was high risk. And they said, you're going to have to suffer, and you're going to have to forgive. Like, if you read Martin Luther King's letter from the Birmingham City Jail, he talks about, you're going to have to embrace suffering, because you're going to get beat up. But he had a longer vision, and it's high risk. And that's where I think Machiavelli's limited, is that he's not, you know, his advice to the prince is, this is what you need to maintain your power at all costs, so to speak. And that's, in my view, is a limited vision, you know, assuming you're willing to risk suffering. That's what Machiavelli's not willing to risk. But the payoff from suffering is much more than what you can garner just from his own methods. I don't know if that's fair.
Yeah, thanks.